Chapter 12. The Summit. The maglev train glides across the English countryside before plunging into the tunnel that will take it under London. Propelled by the magnetic levitation that gave it its name, the train floats 4 inches above the track, the lack of friction allowing it to reach speeds of 300 miles per hour. There are very few such trains left in the world. Japan, China, and South Korea still have them, but the transport revolution in Europe had the misfortune to collide with the environmental, financial, and social meltdown that led to the great cash-out. This one has been restored and maintained, and it is a beautiful thing. A sleek silver bullet that is almost silent, with windows that allow no one to look in, but which provide passengers with a panoramic view of the landscape as it flashes past.
Its destination is the Shard building by London Bridge.
Once London's tallest skyscraper, the Shard always had a train station nestling in its foundations, but that station was closed to the public long ago. After a £1 billion conversion, this stretch of what was once the Northern Line now serves only the businessmen who still find it necessary to meet and work in the building. By far the largest of these, the Biogenesis Corporation, occupies 20 floors, 10 of which have been remodeled to provide luxury accommodation for its staff. There is a wellness centre incorporating a heated swimming pool and gym, a supermarket, a cinema, 3 restaurants, a roof garden, a creche. If you live in the Shard, you don't ever need to go outside, which is just as well because, given the way things are, who would want to? Staff members who live outside London are occasionally permitted to use the maglev when the time comes for their annual leave, but there is one carriage that is reserved for the most senior executives. It is lavishly appointed with widely spaced leather seats, a thick carpet, and soft lighting. The private bar stocks every spirit you could imagine, along with vintage wines you won't find anywhere else. A world-class chef travels with his team in a well-appointed kitchen, and given enough time, he will produce a 5-course meal of extraordinary decadence. Someone once coined the phrase, "It is better to travel than to arrive." Never has it been truer than when applied to this train. There are 8 executives in the carriage today. They are all CEOs of businesses with no affiliation to Biogenesis, 5 men and 3 women. They are not competitors either, working in quite different fields, although perhaps the train is a deliberate reminder that none of them is quite as big or quite as wealthy as their host. They know each other well but do not speak to each other. They are not interested in small talk, and to discuss the agenda that has brought them to this summit meeting would be considered gauche and inappropriate. Better to immerse themselves in their iPads and avoid eye contact. Exactly on time, the maglev slows down and stops in the station which no longer has any name. It doesn't need one. The platform stretches out, perfectly clean. The curving walls, which once would have carried advertisements, now have TV screens which project, with crystal clarity, the accomplishments of the various businesses. The passengers may not be aware of it, but cameras connected to facial recognition software will ensure that their own activities are represented at the exact moment they walk past. So, for example, as the CEO of Boss Meat Foods steps onto the platform, the first thing she sees is a promotion for the laboratory that breeds the insects that her customers will devour. Waiting for them is the Chief Operating Officer of Biogenesis, number 2 to the chairman himself. It is not a job that he enjoys. Jonathan Bloor is a hideous man. He has lost all his hair, even his eyebrows, and there is something reptilian about his skin which wraps itself tightly around his skull, seems to pour itself over his face, and continues down the length of his neck before mercifully disappearing behind his shirt collar. His eyes are black and empty of emotion, apart from a certain smouldering malice. He is wearing a dark, 3-piece suit that has been tailored for him at great expense, but which does him no favours, only accentuating the twisted, skeletal nature of his frame. The watch chain across his chest is an absurd affectation. Yes, it is solid gold. It is surely antique, but nobody dresses like that anymore. Like the monogrammed letters JB on his shirt sleeves, the watch chain belongs to another age. Bloor would be a laughingstock at Biogenesis, except that anyone who laughed at him would know they would be unlikely to survive the day.
Would he commit murder? Of course not. He is a businessman. But he has the power to so destroy a person's life that they might well wish to die, and it is said that when he makes an employee redundant, he does so in every sense of the word. They have no further reason to live. Right now, he is angry. He has been given the role of meeter and greeter, standing on this platform trying to twist his mouth into something resembling a smile as these non-entities dismount from the maglev. Why him? Why not send a secretary or a PA? Blore wonders if he's being tested. Perhaps the man who employs him was hoping he would complain or even refuse to belittle himself in this way. Is that why he was sent down here? Is it some sort of test? But Jonathan Blore is smart enough not to protest, never to question the orders he is given. Loyalty is his watchword, but it is a loyalty primarily to himself. He is extremely well paid. He has a seat at the top table. Why would he risk any of that just because his feelings have been hurt? There is something else that is annoying him. It's been a year since a troublesome molar in the lower half of his mouth was extracted and replaced by an extremely expensive dentist in New Harley Street in Oxford. But today, he has a toothache. How is that even possible, when the new tooth is made of porcelain? The pain is not helped by the fact that he did not sleep well last night. The girl he was with, a junior secretary from R&D, snored. He will have her fired. However, the executives are drawing nearer, and so, ignoring the tooth and putting his humiliation to one side, he forces a smile to his face and spreads his hands in welcome. One or two of them have luggage, and a snap of his fingers brings lackeys to help carry them, and that gives him a sense of satisfaction. He does not converse with the new arrivals for much the same reason that they ignore each other. He has nothing to say. A high-speed elevator, big enough for twice their number, takes them up to the 12th floor, where a stretch of expensive carpet directs them towards the main conference room. Inside, there is a gleaming conference table designed by Paul Somani in 19th-century Paris and once owned by the Empress Eugenie, with 10 lavishly appointed chairs. Exotic fruit, soft drinks, tea, coffee, pastries, and luxurious canapes have been provided. A handsome rosewood tea chest inlaid with ivory stands on a buffet to one side. As the guests arrive, they take out their mobile phones and place them inside. The chest has been adapted for a very different use. It is lead-lined. When the lid is closed, the phones are neutralized. They cannot be turned into listening devices. In fact, the entire room has been designed with security first and foremost in mind. It is windowless, devoid of any unnecessary decoration, and soundproofed. The lighting strips are powered by batteries, no laptops are permitted, which is why none of the executives is carrying one, and the paint used on the walls contains signal-blocking aluminium oxide particles. Electronic pens and notepads are forbidden. The wall was scanned for listening devices before the meeting. Even the drinks and snacks, the plates and glasses were passed through a scanner before they were laid out. Mycroft Holmes has already taken his place at the head of the table. He waits while his visitors jostle for position. How typical that Ivan Alyshkovsky, creator of the one cryptocurrency to survive the second half of the century, should grab the seat next to him. The Russians always were drawn to power. Nor is it surprising that Lachlan Kleiss should be the last person to take his seat. Half German, half Irish, the financier is making a statement in his own way. I will take my own time. Nobody will tell me what to do. Mycroft waits until everyone is ready. He nods at Jonathan Blore, who closes the door quietly, locking it from the inside and positioning himself as a sentinel. Then he begins.
My friends, I want to thank you for attending the summit, particularly at such short notice. I'm sure you'll all agree that given the extremely unfortunate developments of the last week, it was sensible to bring our meeting forward.
All 8 executives show no emotion, but Mycroft knows them well enough by now to tell that they are nervous, and so they should be. The most fearless member of the group is no longer with them. The 10th chair has been left in place quite deliberately to remind everyone, as if they need reminding, that Dost Akbar is dead. Even so, his ghost is very much there, casting a useful chill over the room. Mycroft, who has read over 1,000 books in his lifetime, has been inspired by Macbeth's guilt-ridden supper with the ghost of Banquo, Act 3, Scene 4. The table's full. There's nothing like a violent death to concentrate the mind. "We will all miss Dost Akbar," he continues. "He was someone who spoke his mind, maybe too often and too forcefully for my taste, but then, I'm sure you'd agree, I've always tried to create a sense of independence at these gatherings of ours." Nobody would agree at all. The exact opposite is true. But Biogenesis is the most powerful and the most dangerous organization in the world. At the cutting edge of bioscience, weapons development, genetics, and DNA engineering. There are presidents and prime ministers, dictators even, who would resign before they would argue with Mycroft Holmes, even though he is only in his early 30s, with the smooth, clean looks of a Californian accountant, or perhaps a cosmetic surgeon. Mycroft is by far the youngest person in the room, but it is not just his age that separates him from the assembled businessmen and women. There is a sort of carelessness about him, a knowledge of his own genius that allows him to speak and act exactly as he pleases in the certainty that nobody will dare challenge him. The experiments that he has initiated at Biogenesis will change the world, have already changed the world, in ways that they could never imagine. It is his world now, not theirs. He is their Ozymandias, and on his slender shoulders he feels the weight not of history, but of the future. He does not show any of this in his appearance. The wireframe spectacles that he wears suggests intelligence, while the t-shirt, jeans, and unstructured jacket are deliberately relaxed and informal, the complete opposite of his second-in-command's chosen wardrobe. This is a man who does not need to dress up. His hair is long and very straight, framing a feline, gender-fluid face. He wears sneakers. He has houses in Hawaii and the Maldives, and likes to work from the beach. A gold signet ring is his one affectation. He likes to turn it while he makes up his mind. Two twists, and the decision will be made. "I'm still investigating, but I have to say it's pretty clear to me that he brought this shit on himself. I advised him to stick with it, not to break ranks with the rest of our group. He disagreed." Mycroft sighs. "What happened was completely predictable." "Akbar was a fool," Kleiss exclaims. "And his stupidity hasn't just led to his own death, not to mention all those people on the plane. He has damaged us all." He looks accusingly at Mycroft. "There are some who would say your own authority has taken a severe knock." "And would you be one of them, Lachlan?" The question sounds innocent. Mycroft has the whisper of a smile on his lips. A certain spark of mischief dances in his eyes. But the challenge hangs in the air. Lachlan considers for a moment, but unlike Dost, he has no wish to commit suicide. "Not at all, Mycroft. But it has allowed Red Circle to demonstrate their strength, or, to put it another way, to expose our weakness." "I always warned you this might happen." This comes from Margot Schultz, the boss meat executive, a spider-like woman, dressed all in black with spindly arms and legs. "If you give in to blackmailers, the result is inevitable. The price rises." "But it hasn't risen. Not for years and years." "It's risen now," Deborah Crane says. Her media, entertainment, and leisure empire is worth many billions of pounds, but she is short and rather drab, wearing a tight-fitting dress that could be off the peg, and an ugly necklace made of what looks like marbles. "They've doubled the price we have to pay." "We're all paying because of Dost," Mycroft reminds her. "Why should we? I went along with this because you persuaded us it was the right thing to do, Mycroft. I'm not questioning your judgment, but this is a game changer. Suddenly the demands aren't so reasonable." "They were never reasonable," Lachlan interjects. "They were manageable," Deborah insists. "They still are. But who's to say that won't change next week or the week after? Dost may have broken the rules, but so have Red Circle. They never gave us an opportunity for renegotiation, and I, for one, don't like having a gun put to my head." "When is this going to end?" The question comes from Makito Kawakami, whose mining interests have quite literally changed the face of the world. This is the man who bankrupted De Beers, who has now cornered the market not just in diamonds, but in a dozen rare metals. He is originally from Tokyo, but left the city when it degenerated in exactly the same way as London. He now lives on a private island in Kamijima. We have to find them. He bangs his hand on the table to emphasize his point.
You think we're not trying? Mycroft replies. Come on, guys. I have a feeling we've spent almost as much money trying to find these bastards as we've actually given them. We've got a whole team of data experts and technicians at Biogenesis working round the clock. At my own personal expense. We're all over the internet, the dark net, the micro net, and all the other nets. We've spoken to some of the world's most notorious hackers and offered huge bribes. We're working with the security services of a dozen different countries, but nothing. The Red Circle are extremely good. How else do you think they managed to hack into Eastern Airlines security and bring down a fucking plane? When I do find out who they are, I might as well hire them.
It is unclear if he is joking or not.
So we just let them run circles around us. Kleiss's words are almost mocking. We keep on paying them whatever they demand until they bankrupt us. Somebody in this room needs to have some backbone.
Are you serious?
Mycroft looks around him in apparent confusion. Then he smiles coldly.
I'll pretend I didn't hear who said that, because, you know, for a moment I thought Dost Akbar with his indigestible opinions had returned to us. But that's impossible.
The smile fades.
Because Dost and the 400 other victims of his backbone have just been scraped off the ground.
Nobody says anything. Mycroft twists the gold signet ring on his finger. When he speaks again, he's more reasonable.
We have no choice. We must keep paying, he says quietly.
First of all, let's be realistic. The cost of my company to Biogenesis is almost nothing, not considered in the scheme of things. What's 50,000 a month when you're making a billion a year? Is there anyone in this room who feels otherwise? Because if these payments seem too extravagant for your profit margins, then perhaps you shouldn't be in the room at all.
Nobody speaks.
That's why Red Circle is so smart, Mycroft continues. They know they have a captive market, but they've kept their prices reasonable, even now with their new demands.
They're still running a protection racket, Kleiss says more quietly. They're still blackmailing us.
My advice to you, and I've said this before, is not to think of it as extortion. What we're doing is buying time. Simple as that. Red Circle can't hide from us forever. One day they'll make a mistake. They have to. They'll show themselves somehow, and then we'll make our move.
And then?
Akito asks.
We'll cut their balls off and set fire to them. I don't know. You tell me, Akito. We'll do whatever makes us feel better about all this.
Mycroft Holmes allows the delegates to take all this in. There are other matters to discuss, business opportunities of mutual interest, and he is keen to move on. But first, he needs to know.
Come on, guys, we're all agreed that the stupidity of one man, Dost Akbar, has threatened us all. We can't allow that to happen again, so I've got to know. Got to be honest with me and with each other. Is there anyone else in the room who intends to hold back payment and risk pushing Red Circle into more outrages?
The delegates' heads are bent. No hand goes up. Not even Kleiss's.
Well, that's a relief.
Mycroft swings round in his seat and places two sneakered feet on the table.
So, let's move on to other things. Let's talk about how much money we've been making and push the losses to one side. Who wants to go first?
The meeting breaks up 2 hours later, and after they have collected their mobile phones, Jonathan Bloor takes the executives down to the waiting train. As they stand in the lift, he examines their faces carefully, looking for the little clues that might lead him to their thoughts. Sure enough, is the first thing Mycroft wants to know when he returns.
Well?
Kleiss wasn't happy.
Kleiss is a miserable bastard at the best of times, but we'll keep an eye on him. What about the rest of them?
They listened to you. I think the summit went well.
Mycroft shakes his head. You're so wrong, Jonathan. I'm sorry, you just don't get it. He takes off his wireframe spectacles, blows on the glass, wipes them on his shirt, and puts them back on again.
I had to threaten them to bring them into line.
Only because of Kleiss.
Kleiss is the canary in the coal mine. I'm losing control of them. You heard Kawakami and that bitch, Margot Schultz. They're too dumb and too arrogant to accept the current situation for very much longer. One of them will do something reckless that screws all of us.
So you're going ahead?
More than that, I'm accelerating the process. I want us to be out by the end of the week. Bloor is shocked. Even with the maglev, it's a huge operation. Closing down the business in London, moving all the Biogenesis servers out of the city, transporting them to a secure facility that has already been prepared in the Scottish Highlands. Buried under 500 metres of solid granite, doing all this without anyone knowing.
This week, he mutters. It's already Wednesday. That leaves about 48 hours.
Yes, I can manage basic maths, thank you, Jonathan. Mycroft gives his COO a thin smile. I'm not sure how long we've got until one of those idiots pisses Red Circle off a second time. And what do you think will happen then? We could be the next target. They could take a shot at me. Or at you, for that matter.
If Red Circle finds out what you're planning, they'll come for you anyway.
They won't. They can't. We've only ever talked about this here, in this room, where it's safe. There's nothing in writing. As far as anyone's concerned, we're just moving some of the servers for maintenance. And this is need to know, right? Our people just get a few details, and you and I are the only ones with the big picture.
What about the others? Kleiss, Alashkovsky, Schultz, and the rest of them. If you disappear, Red Circle may decide to punish them.
You really think I give a damn? The whole lot of them can go to hell in a handcart, as far as I'm concerned. Once we're in Scotland, we won't need them anymore, and we're better off without them.
Mycroft slides his sneakered feet off the table and gets up. But he doesn't yet leave the room.
One other thing. What news of our boy?
It was the question Bloor has been dreading.
Nothing yet, he admits. I've been doing everything I can. We've been out on the street, we've circulated his photograph to all the usual suspects. There's a reward for information and all the rest of it, but so far nothing.
You know I don't like to be disappointed.
Of course, I'm hopeful we'll have a breakthrough very soon.
Is he still in London?
I can't say for sure. I have people at all the main railway terminals, and we may have had a sighting at Victoria Station, but it was unconfirmed. Two men, he was one of them, and they were only going to West Norwood.
West Norwood?
Mycroft isn't even sure he knew the place existed.
I'm sorry. We don't know anything more.
Well, we need to find him, ideally before we leave ourselves.
Mycroft languidly waves the hand with the signet ring.
I have to say I'm disappointed in you, Jonathan. You told me you had subdued him, broken his spirit. That was your job. To make him understand that we were the ones who controlled what he thought and what he did. If you allowed him to pull the wool over your eyes, you let him get away.
And there it is, exactly what Bloor was expecting. The accusation. The reason why he was demoted and sent to meet the train. Bloor feels a pulse of anger that starts somewhere behind his eyes and travels through his entire body, almost like an electric shock. For a brief moment he is tempted to speak out, but that would be suicidal. Instead, he says,
Give me time. I'll get him back.
How much time? Mycroft asks.
We're closing in.
I think your time is running out.
Mycroft smiles sadly, and then he's gone. Mycroft's last words, the slight sigh he made when he stood up, the creak of the chair and his light footsteps across the carpet, like every other sound from the meeting, have all been overheard. Every word spoken has been recorded and will soon be turned into transcripts which the members of Red Circle will pore over and discuss. They were recorded by a microscopic bug inserted into Bloor's false tooth when he received his treatment 1 year ago. The dentist who did the work had decided that he did not wish to see his wife and three children put to death in front of him before he was killed himself, and decided to do exactly as he was told. The Red Circle can be very persuasive.